Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, how low will they go? Simon asks, as the Bank of England cuts interest rates this week, citing Trump's trade war as a key reason. Will a UK-US deal stall the cuts? And can anyone safely predict anything with the Donald in the White House? Also today, will the new inheritance tax levy on pensions see retirees splash more cash on holidays? Crane is back on the case, taking a higher company to task over an EV nightmare. And as more companies demand staff return to the office, is the working from home era over? And what does that mean for house prices and the race for space? Don't forget to update with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the Bank of England cut interest rates this week, despite no movement by the Fed the day before. President Trump's trade war was cited as one of the key reasons for reducing the rate of borrowing from 4.5% to 4.25%. Now, the decision came shortly before we got official confirmation of a trade deal between Britain and the US. So while the decision to cut rates came as no surprise to anyone, the direction of travel going forward is less certain. Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Helen. Simon, firstly, what was behind the Bank of England's decision?
Thanks, Georgie. Yeah, another cut. What was behind the Bank of England's decision was, in its own words, progress in reducing inflationary pressures allows us to cut interest rates again. Inflation is following a bumpy path. It will increase temporarily this year before falling back to the 2% target. The key bit in that is temporarily. Changes in global trade policies will impact the economy. To ensure inflation stays low, we will judge carefully how far and how fast to cut interest rates. So basically, Bank of England says inflation is on its way back to the 2% target. It's not that far above it. That it expects an increase in inflation this year, and it's likely to rise temporarily to as high as 3.7%. But that is because of higher energy prices, and those are seen as a one-off rather than inflationary pressure within the economy. Inflation is then expected to fall back to the 2% target. There's a lot of uncertainty going on. The Bank of England is concerned about the impact of Donald Trump's tariffs on global trade and business sentiment in an economy that is already slowing. We've had some not great figures coming out on the UK economy. The growth that the new government promised us is yet to arrive and may not arrive for some time. Businesses have not been a fan of the national insurance rise. They've also seen other costs come through in terms of a higher minimum wage. Although actually you would like to think that that money would then feed back through into the economy. But the Labour government, although it arrived with a mission for growth, didn't arrive with the short-term levers to pull really to deliver that growth. It's more long-term thinking, and that's the kind of stuff that will take quite a while to come through. So the Bank of England is looking at this, and it's a bit concerned about what's going to go on in the economy. And although the Monetary Policy Committee's remit is not to support the economy, it is to keep inflation to the 2% target, it sees those deflationary pressures, you know, the slowing economy, as being likely to send inflation down through that 2% target eventually, unless we cut interest rates. And the reason why you cut interest rates is because at the simplest level, it makes it cheaper for people to borrow money. Banks pass that money on, pass that cut on. It makes it cheaper for people to borrow money and businesses to borrow money, which should stimulate demand for borrowing money and should therefore stimulate the economy. And regardless of the trade deal that was announced yesterday afternoon after the Bank of England decision, that's not going to make a huge difference to the problems that the Bank of England sees coming globally and at a higher level from tariffs, rather than dependent on whether we can send 100,000 cars to the US or not.
We'll go into that in more detail, Simon. Tell us what happened. So are you not blown away by this new trade deal that's going to bring loads of money into the UK and the special relationship, Simon?
I was 100% blown away by watching Donald Trump and Keir Starmer have a conversation where Keir Starmer was coming out over an old-fashioned desk phone, and the two of them talked for quite some time. Donald Trump demonstrated why, for his many, many, many faults, and I would choose Keir Starmer over Donald Trump as the leader of our country any day, he is a lot more box office than Keir Starmer, who droned on for quite a long time about VE Day, 80 years, special relationship, all that kind of stuff. Peter Mandelson made a special appearance. It was like watching one of those movies where you get people wandering on for a cameo. I was surprised Bojo didn't pop up in the background. But yeah, it was, look, okay, right. We are still in a worse position in terms of trade with the US than we were at the start of the year. We're in a better position than we were when Donald Trump announced his Liberation Day tariffs. We still face the baseline 10% tariff. This is good news for our car industry. This is good news for some other bits of our industry. It's great news for Rolls-Royce, for example. It was presented very much as we've done a great deal with the UK and it's a great deal for us. It's better for the US than it is for them, because that's the American way of posturing on these things. And it's certainly the Donald Trump way of posturing on these things. And he's not going to say we've done a good deal and it's great for both of us. And maybe it's totally fair. He wants the American public to think that they've got the better end out of this deal. Maybe they have. I don't think it's such a bad deal. What I would say is a fair play to the government for managing to put us at the front of that queue and for it to be the first trade deal announced since the Liberation Day tariffs were introduced, regardless of the content. That is a really good platform to be building on, and it's a good place to be, and it indicates that they have managed in quite a difficult scenario, considering what the general Labour Party view of Donald Trump and the Republican Party is, to cement that special relationship and rekindle the flame. So take my hat off, because that's actually quite an impressive achievement.
That's nice, bit of positivity. I'll bring Helen in shortly to talk about what all this means for our money and interest rates. But before I do, I just wanted to ask you, while we're over on the other side of the pond, as it were, the Fed's decision to hold. Don't think Donald Trump would be too pleased with that.
Well, the Fed's in a very sticky position, not just because Donald Trump thinks Jerome Powell is an idiot, a moron, a fool. I don't know whatever he said about him most recently, although he's not going to sack him, which is good news. The Fed's in a very difficult position. And I said this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I wrote it in my column this week, and I'll say it again. We've gone from the position of interest rates aren't going to fall this year because Donald Trump is US president to interest rates are going to have to fall this year because Donald Trump is US president. That's a simpler situation for the UK and Europe to deal with, because Donald Trump's policies are, you know, going to dampen the economies over here and potentially could lead to lower inflation for us, because you might suddenly see a flood of cheap goods coming into the UK and Europe off the back of them not being able to go to the US. It's an altogether more difficult position for the US, because on one hand, it appears that Donald Trump appears to be perfectly happy to send the US into recession. You would try to get ahead of that and cut interest rates. However, the inflation that it looked like Donald Trump was going to deliver due to his, you know, business-friendly policies and sort of tax cuts and all that kind of stuff also looks like it might arrive, but even worse, because he's going to add some inflationary pressure by putting tariffs on goods that are coming from overseas, which are going to get more expensive and will therefore drive up the cost of things for Americans to buy. And they're not necessarily going to see the full impact of those tariffs. And we actually saw an interesting thing on this from Ferrari this week, which revealed that basically it's probably going to have to raise prices in the US by about 10%. Now, bearing in mind there's a 25% tariff on those Ferraris, that indicates that Ferrari and some of its dealers are going to absorb some of those tariffs. And we've seen quite a bit of this, you know, noises of businesses saying we're going to have to absorb maybe half of this, maybe even a bit more of it. I think they don't feel they can pass on the full price to the American consumer, certainly not straight away. But it is going to create inflationary pressure in the US. And so the Fed is saying, well, look, we don't know what the outcome's going to be yet. So we're going to sit on our hands, and we don't need to cut rates because actually the American economy is still pretty much going good guns. So they're in a much more difficult position, and not just because the president has made it abundantly clear that he would very much like them to cut interest rates, and they're morons for not doing it.
I imagine, though, that Ferrari buyers, given the nature of a Ferrari, you could probably take a fair few grand more, maybe. But then I was hearing toy shops, for example, have already ordered their products from China for Christmas. How on earth are they going to cover the, I don't even know where the tariffs are at. I think Donald Trump suggested now 80% is his first bargaining chip with China, but I don't know where we are with tariffs on this. But ultimately, it will hurt businesses and consumers. But how will that trickle down to us and our money?
Because this entire thing upsets the apple cart. And by upsetting the apple cart, you depress business sentiment. Businesses are already making decisions to row back on some planned spending, some planned investment in their businesses. You know, perhaps you're a business and you've been thinking, right, we're going to try and expand. We're going to take on some more people. We're going to invest in our business. We might need to like invest in some new IT infrastructure. We might need to buy more materials to make more stuff. We might rent an extra building. We might do all those other things. A lot of those decisions are being placed on ice, or people are going, okay, well, we won't do that right now. We'll wait to the future. And then the impact of that, it rolls over. And because that business doesn't spend that money, the people they were going to spend it with, they don't get that money and so on. And you start to, you know, spending money gives you this economic multiplier effect. And when people don't spend money, you get the opposite of that occurring. And in fact, you might even get businesses cutting back. You might get more businesses deciding to lay some people off preemptively because they think they're going to be hit by this. We saw this in the UK, actually. It's quite a good case study of this in terms of the national insurance hike for employers, where what you saw running ahead of the national insurance hike for employers and the rise in the minimum wage was a lot of businesses for whom staffing was a big cost make some cuts. And that was before it had even come in. They just did it. They did it preemptively. Now, it might be that they were looking for an excuse to make some cuts anyway, to trim what they saw as fat and be a bit leaner. But they might not have done that if it were not for this policy that is coming in. And it's exactly the same situation. And to go back to what I said at the start of the podcast, this is why the Bank of England is worried. Because, you know, if one business does this, it doesn't really matter. But if lots of businesses do this, in aggregate, the effect becomes quite large. And it means that even potentially over here, where we would be relatively insulated from some of this stuff, because, you know, if you look at it on paper, you go, well, do you know what? It's probably not going to make that much difference to the UK economy. The UK economy is a very open economy. It trades a lot with the rest of the world. And that means that, you know, when that sentiment contracts and goes downhill, then it does affect us. Now, what you might find is that actually we're already over the worst of it. There is a strong possibility that the UK economy is going to pick up substantially in the second half of this year. But it might not. But we better hope it does. Because otherwise our taxes are going up again.
Yeah, quite. Helen, thank you for being so patient, talking about taxes, talking about the pounds in our pockets and all that. Just focusing on this cut and the lead up to it, and I suppose throwing in what some of the predictions are going forward, but mainly how does this affect our money? What's happening to mortgage rates?
Well, as we always say, when there's a base rate cut, that tends to bring down mortgage rates, but also bring down savings rates. In reality, it's actually not quite that simple. So I had someone ask me earlier this week who's got a remortgage deadline coming up, should I wait till after the base rate announcement because I think my lender's going to bring out some cheaper mortgage rates? And it's not quite that simple anymore. So mortgage lenders have been bringing down rates for a while. And they'll continue to bring down rates after this. Like in general, the long-term trend is that because the base rate is going lower and the forecast is it's going to keep going lower, they are bringing down rates, but it's not so linked to every individual base rate decision. So at the minute, we've got mortgage rates well below 4% in some cases. This week, Nationwide has bought out a two-year fix, which is 3.84%. That's a lot though lower than we were seeing even a year ago. So the general trend is down. And, you know, if you've got a remortgage coming up, if you're looking to buy, you're going to be getting much better rates than you were, say, at this time last year, but people might also be thinking, where is this going in the future? So I think we've touched on this before, but the predictions for the base rate coming down later in the year, thinking maybe two or three more cuts this year, which would take the rate to 3.75 or 3.5%. And actually, the best mortgage rates at the minute are already getting close to that level. If we look at swap rates, which is the sort of future facing rate where banks sort of lend money to each other, they're already at 3.5%. So all these rates are kind of converging, and it sort of suggests that mortgage rates aren't really going to go that much lower. We actually had in our article on the base rate this week, Ed, a reporter who wrote it, spoke to Rachel Hunnisett, who works for the lender April Mortgages, and I thought she summed it up really well. So she said, markets are already priced in a series of base rate cuts, and lenders have adjusted their pricing accordingly. That means any further falls in mortgage rates may be limited unless economic data shifts unexpectedly. Borrowers shouldn't build their financial plans around the hope of cheaper deals ahead. That's speculative and it could backfire, which I think is really sensible advice. You know, rates are moving in the right direction, but don't expect that they're going to get really bargain basement, because they probably won't. And if you see a deal now that suits you can afford it, it's probably a decent idea to take it.
Simon, the reality though is, as Helen said there, three cuts. Is it four? Is it two? Is it none? Can we predict anything in this environment anymore?
No, because it's May. And in January, we were maybe only going to get one cut this year. But in October, we were maybe going to get three cuts this year. And now we're going to get four cuts this year. Nobody really knows. These things change around all the time, which, as Helen said, makes it quite risky to bet on wishful thinking. What you need to do is do what's right for you at the time. The current best guess from the markets and economists is that we're going to see another three base rate cuts, which would take us down to 3.5%. We might see another one than that. We might see one less than that. I think what is clear is that we're not going back down to super low levels. We're not even going down to anywhere near the super low levels that we saw. So bearing in mind that base rate was 0.5% for a really, really long time, and then post-COVID it was lower than that. Even if we went to 2%, we'd be well above where we were. But nobody, like hardly anybody, is suggesting that we're going to 2%. And if we go to 2%, it'll be off the back of some major crisis. Central banks are still dealing with the hangover from those super low interest rate years, and they don't want to go back down to there. So unless you get some, mega event, financial crisis, COVID, something like that, which, like, fingers crossed, we're not going to, then we aren't going back down there. I am in the position personally of needing to remortgage in September, so my plan is to try to lock into a rate ASAP. I am going to wave a sad goodbye to my 1.4% 5-year fixed mortgage. I know that good old friend, that trusty friend that's seen me through. I wish I'd taken a 10-year fixed rate mortgage 5 years ago. I tell you what, I
Like your
really,
mum said.
like my mum said, yeah, you're going to regret that, she said. And I do. So I'm looking at, I'm in the fortunate position where we've got quite a lot of equity in our house because we've owned property for a long time. I'm looking at just below 4% at the moment. Now, if we could fix at 3.5%, I'd be a happy boy. I'll take that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to use our This Is Money's fee-free mortgage finder service with L&C. Speak to them, can try and lock into a deal now. And if rates fall between now and September, which I'm very much hoping they do, then I will jump ship to a cheaper deal closer to the time, because you're not locked in. You don't actually have to take the mortgage, add the fees to the loan. You don't pay any fees up front, and you should be able to just jump ship when you want before you take the mortgage out. So that's my plan with that. I'd also say to savers that it's worth considering, if you do want to lock money away on a fixed rate, act now, ASAP, because those fixed rates are going to start vanishing. You can still get cash ISAs that are paying 5%, but I don't expect them to last much longer. And one trick that we highlighted today is potentially to take one of these ones with the bonuses, the short-term bonuses on, because you, whilst they might change the underlying rate, you are locking in that bonus. And they could lower that bonus at any time for new customers. But if you've locked in that bonus for the 3 months or something, or maybe even the 12-month one, then that at least gives you a bit of protection. And just Before I finish, one interesting thing in the Bank of England's monetary policy report that indicates why there's still this pressure kind of slowing down the economy is that actually, although they're cutting rates at the moment, the impact of them raising rates still hasn't fully trickled through. So when you look at this chart, the effective interest rate on the stock of UK mortgages, it's still rising, but at a slower pace than in recent years. And what this shows is that there's still mortgages out there that people took when rates were super low that they haven't rolled off the back of. So the effective rate on the existing stock of mortgages is just below 4% at the moment. Now, it was just below 2% in kind of 2021, 2022. But most people, if they were to have to go get a new mortgage, wouldn't be getting rates just below 4%. They'd be paying more than 4%. They'd probably be paying closer to 4.5 to 5. So there's still some way to go from the impact of the rate rises that we saw at the same time as the Bank of England is cutting rates to try to stimulate things. So you've got a bit of a push me pull you thing going on here.
All right, well, we'll leave this to one side for now and we'll move on to Labour's move to include pensions into the inheritance tax net. We'll see, apparently, wealthier retirees splashing out on more holidays to avoid the levy. So from April 2027, pensions will become liable for death duties, just like other assets such as your property, savings, and investments. Now, according to a survey from financial planner RBC Brewin Dolphin, well over half of over 45s with at least 300,000 already set aside for retirement plan to spend more to dodge inheritance tax, with holidays the most popular plan. Helen, before we dig into this a little bit more, what are the plans with pensions and inheritance tax? What will it mean?
This is something that was announced in the autumn budget back in October, hugely controversial Labour policy. But the long and short of it is that in the past, pensions, personal pensions, could be left to your family without the same sort of inheritance tax as if you'd left that money in the form of sort of savings or property. So people are essentially using it as a bit of a backdoor to pass on money to their children without the tax they'd have to pay if they gave them that money in essentially in cash or investments or sort of highly more highly taxed assets. So as you said, that's closing from April 27, and we're now seeing people essentially trying to get rid of that money before it falls into the tax net. And as this survey has shown, a lot of people are planning to go on a lovely big holiday. Which fair enough, I say, not really lucky for their children, but trying to splash the cash.
I'll get into that in more detail, but I just doesn't it just throw financial planning quite a lot out of the water? Because you literally don't know how much you're going to have. I mean, you know how much your house is worth, so you can sort of factor that in. But it really depends on when you pop your clogs as to how much you've got in your pension pot. You may be over the limit, you may be under the limit. So it sort of throws everything up in the air, doesn't it?
It does to an extent, and yeah, notoriously difficult to predict when you're going to die, which is what makes it quite tricky. Some people do have these huge pension pots, and I think people have done this definitely with an eye to leaving money to their children, I think, especially sort of wealthier people. But you're right, there are people who have just saved sensibly and are going to live a long time. So it's you don't want to penalize those people who've saved sensibly, but then also there is this kind of loophole issue. So it's a really tricky policy, I think.
So let's discuss this survey that says we're all going to splash the cash. I mean, there is a more serious note in this. I mean, one, you shouldn't, and I think the point is you shouldn't be using your pension as an inheritance tax thing anyway. Your pension is there to serve you through retirement, right? That's why you save. But is there a worry now that people are so concerned about the inheritance tax that they're going to perhaps oversplurge? Are we going to have the Lamborghini effect that we never had before?
Look, if you are in retirement and you still have a large defined contribution pension pot and you are comfortable with the fact that you have enough income coming in from elsewhere that you don't need that, so you are in the scenario where you were potentially just going to pass it on to your children, for example, then yeah, spend it. Like if you're worried about the inheritance tax, spend it, because if you're going to be over the inheritance tax threshold, then Everything you buy is 40% off. Go on that holiday, it's 40% off. Fly business class, it's 40% off. Go out to dinner, it's 40% off. Because otherwise, that tax money is going to be taxed at 40% when you die, right? Give the money away now. Take advantage of the 7-year rule. Use this surplus income rule, which means that if it's income that's generally surplus to requirements and you give it away regularly, then you can give it away and you don't actually need to worry about the 7-year rule for now. This is something I could potentially see changing. And actually, we're going to get that explained in a minute in our Charles Stanley bit by Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley. But yeah, do that. But do think about this a bit more. Now, we talked over 45s here. Those over 45s can't get their pension for a start, right? They're going to have to wait till they're 57 to get their pension. So it's only the people who are over 55 at the moment and 57 shortly, because the age is going up, who can actually spend this money. But do be careful, looking at that pot and allowing the tax tail to wag the dog and thinking, oh, I need to give this money away, because actually, once I add this to my house, I'm going to have to pay inheritance tax on it. Because, if you give it away and you take the money out of your pension, you have to pay tax on that anyway. So it might be that if you take enough money out of your pension to spend a serious amount or give it away to someone, that you pay 40% tax on it, because you bumped yourself up into being a high rate taxpayer. And also remember that, this doesn't actually buy that much income. And this takes me back to why I've got a problem with this policy. So this policy has been directed at what is ultimately a very small number of older, wealthier savers, boomer generation people with large amounts in their pension pots, who actually probably don't need the money because they were the generation that had final salary pension schemes. So there are people out there who've got a final salary pension scheme plus their state pension, which pays them the income they need, and then they've got money in a defined contribution pot they've built up in a personal pension or a SIP, and they plan to just give that away to their kids. Prior to now, if they died before the age of 75, it could be given away tax-free. But if they died after the age of 75, then there was no inheritance tax to pay, but it was taxed at the recipient's income tax rate when they took the money out. Now, in reality, that means that most of those people who inherited those pots when the person died over the age of 75, which, bear in mind, if you die under the age of 75, you're dying early. So I had no problem with giving those people a tax break, right? If you die after the age of 75 and you take that money out, you're probably going to end up paying higher rate tax on it anyway, the person who's got the money. So it's going to be taxed at 40%, might even be taxed at 45%. And at the moment, we've got a scenario where it hasn't been clarified that double taxation isn't going to happen. So it could be someone dies over the age of 75, it's now including the inheritance tax. The person pays income tax on it. When they take it out, they end up paying 67% tax. But to go back to why I've got a problem with this, you've got a really small number of people who are doing this. The people who this policy impacts the most is not those people, okay? It's a limited number. The people who it impacts is the younger generation, the people in their 30s and their 40s and maybe their early 50s, okay? It's the people who are more likely to be listening to this podcast. It's the three of us having the conversation now, because we don't get final salary pension schemes. We are of the generation that's had to save into defined contribution pension schemes. You invest the money, you build the pot, and then with that pot, you have to buy your retirement income. And in order to do that and to get a decent retirement income, you need to have built up a really big pot. So if you've done what you were meant to have done since your mid-20s and saved into that pension and so on, it is conceivably the case that you might be 45 and you might have a £300,000 pension pot, right? Now, that's a really big pension pot compared to the average, okay? But the average is measured on the what people have got now at retirement quite often. It's not necessarily measured, on the average of what people are going to need for their retirement. And I would argue, and I did actually have this debate with Tanya yesterday, as to whether that makes you wealthy, because a £300,000 pension pot at an industry standard 4% withdrawal rate would provide retirement income of £12,000 a year. Combine that with a full state pension of £12,000 a year, and you've got total income of £24,000 before tax. The Pension Lifetime Savings Association's benchmark figure says a moderate retirement for an individual would cost £31,300 a year after tax and excluding housing costs. You would need a £780,000 pension pot in order to deliver that, right? So In this scenario where you actually had a big enough pension pot to deliver your moderate retirement, not your comfortable retirement, your moderate retirement, add that to your share of your house, you're well into the inheritance tax liability level. And so actually I think my problem with this policy is that it's not really targeting those boomers. It's going to hit the people in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s, the people in their 20s, because all of a sudden the money that they have saved for retirement is going to get dragged into inheritance tax. Now, hopefully, they're going to have a long and enjoyable retirement, and they're going to get to the point where they die, which, as Helen pointed out, is notoriously difficult to predict for many people. And they're not going to have a big pension pot anymore because they'll have run it down and they'll have spent it on enjoying their retirement. But if they die early or something happens, then I think it creates quite an unfair situation.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, I've got a question here from a listener. I have £300,000 in a SIP, a self-invested personal pension, that I don't need to live on. Can I withdraw it and give it away regularly to avoid inheritance tax?
The short answer is yes, but there are some things you need to think about as well. Firstly, don't take too much out of your pension that you're knocking yourself into a higher tax bracket, possibly, because beyond the tax-free 25%, money is just added to the rest of your income and taxed as such. So you could move from 20 to 40 or from 40 to 45% potentially. And the other thing is this strategy needs excellent record keeping. Come the day, your executors will need to demonstrate to the HMRC that this was indeed excess income and it was surplus to your needs. And there's a form, IHT 403, which they'll need to fill out. At the moment, this sort of regular pension withdrawal is treated as income. And under the current rules, it's absolutely a pretty good way of getting money out of your pension now that the rules have changed.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Welcome back. The world's largest asset manager, BlackRock, this week ordered senior management back to the office full time. We're hearing more of these, aren't we? Working from home exploded, of course, during the pandemic, with the race for space pushing up prices of certain types of homes in certain areas. But as workers migrate back to the offices and the cities, we're starting to see the impact, especially in coastal locations. Helen, is the working from home era completely over?
It's mad to think, isn't it, what you were doing this time 5 years ago? I think probably May 2020, I was sitting out on my front step because I didn't have a garden. Quite hot, I think, at that time, sort of drinking a beer and thinking, what on earth is going on with the world? And like, can you know, that 5 years ago, huge. But at the same time, people who weren't living in a rubbish house share in London, or maybe some people that were, thought it'd be a good idea to move to the coast. Wouldn't that be lovely? You know, if you're working from home, have a little lunchtime dip in the sea. Lovely idea, loads of people thought during COVID, or loads of people with the money to do it, I should say. As if we cast our minds back, properties like that by the seaside in the country saw a huge, huge spike in value. But I think over the last few years, some people who've done that have thought, you know, was I maybe a bit hasty to rush away to the middle of nowhere? Because now I've got to go back to the office, maybe not all the time, but more of the time. You know, if you're living down in Devon or somewhere and you're working in London, that's a solid, you know, few hours on the train or driving. And if you're doing that 3 or 4 days a week, yeah, it starts to sort of cut into your lifestyle quite a lot, and also your budget, because as we know, sort of transport isn't cheap. So this is data from the estate agent Hamptons, and they're showing that price falls in those kind of areas have been absolutely huge. So if we look at 2022 to 2024, some of the areas that have seen the biggest house price falls have been areas like Hastings, Thanet, Porridge in Devon, Eastbourne, Torbay, all of these coastal locations. I should point out that actually the top three house price fallers were all in central London, so City of London, Chelsea and Westminster, but they're very sort of niche markets, and they're ruled by things like what's happening to overseas buyers, and you know, that they're a bit of a sort of law unto themselves. So the if we say that the normal areas where house prices are going down, these are all these lovely locations on the coast. So just to give a few of the numbers, Hastings prices fell by 8% to just under £210,000 between 2022 and 2024. You know, these are chunky house price falls. If we look at the latest house price data, on average, prices tended to go up a little bit, about 1% or so year on year in the last year. So, you know, this is a big difference. However, we need to point out that obviously there was this huge spike around the pandemic. So if we look at Hastings, yes, their prices are down in the last couple of years, but they're still up 20% compared to 2019. So, you know, if you own a house there, you're still pretty happy if you've owned it for a while. Or maybe not that happy because all these down from London people and Airbnbs have kind of come in and bought all the lovely flats in your local area. So I think it just shows this interesting trend of you know, maybe the countryside and seaside idyll isn't necessarily all it's cracked up to be. Now we're sort of going back to the office. And actually, interestingly as well, Hampton's looked at the kind of places where prices are going up a lot. And it was places on the outskirts of big cities. So M8 in Manchester, Crumpsall and Cheetham Hill, one of the sort of suburban locations there. They've seen really big rises of about 16% in the last couple of years. Outskirts of Birmingham, outskirts of Leeds, these sort of easily commutable areas where, you know, you can still get a relatively affordable flat or house, but it's easy to get into your job in the city centre. So they seem to be the real sort of hotspots going forward.
Simon, what do you make of all of this? Is working from home over? Are we all going back to the cities? One bed flats in London and Manchester?
No, I don't think it is over. And I think a lot of companies, if they've got a lot of sense, have retained a degree of flexibility on this because it's, you know, ultimately it's a way of retaining staff and keeping staff happy. And if you can keep people a lot happier by allowing them to work from home one day a week or 2 days a week, then, and they can still maintain their productivity and do a good job, then I would say it's definitely worth considering. I mean, it's interesting. It's a lot of the, it's been a big backlash from these big US banks, but then it's because the pendulum swings too far one way, doesn't it? And then it swings too far back the other way. And what this relates to is that kind of presumption post-COVID or in the COVID thing. It's like, we're never going back to the office, you know?
Yeah.
And there was this thing where people were moving further and further away thinking, I mean, they're never going to make me go back in. You know,
and it's mad. Thinking, I rented, these people just got off, bought, like went straight for it. Did then nobody think we would open up again?
They were like, yeah, we'll probably have to go 1 day a week or something. It'll be fine. I can do a day a week. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, we want you in 4 days a week. And they're like, oh, what? I don't know. And then people complain about it. It's like, well, you chose to move. It's like, if you took a new job, right? I understand it. Like if you negotiated as part of your new job, but if you had an existing job, and you chose to move further away, well, that's on you. I mean, there's still a huge degree of reluctance in some quarters and in some organisations. And I'm not going to start making sweeping, you know, public-private sector generalisations here, but I think there is potentially a bit of a dividing line. But there was a dividing line before there. You know, many of those people had more flexible scenarios. There are some complaints from people working for some businesses who were like, where the pendulum swung so far back the other way, they're like, this is less flexible than it was before COVID. But yeah, it was a genuine thing. I think the other thing that has to be taken into account here is also the Airbnb and down from Londoner second home effect, which is definitely waning. Okay, it has got much more expensive to buy a second home. It has got more expensive to have that second home in many instances. There have been crackdowns in places on people Airbnb-ing properties. There was quite a bit of that. People buy them and go, this is a nice little learner. And it's not quite as nice little, much a nice little learner. And then you've also got the scenario where lots of people buy a second home or buy a place as an investment to Airbnb out. And then a few years in, they realize it's just not worth the hassle. That actually they're not using it that much. They're not making as much money. They're shocked that they have to pay tax on this income. And they decide that actually, do you know what? I might as well just sell it. And there's not the demand coming in from new people to do that. So I think there is a degree of that as well that's going on. Because quite frankly, like, I'd love the idea of a second home. It'd be nice to have a holiday home, wouldn't it? But it's like, I can barely keep on top of having one house. I don't know how people keep on top of having two. It's like when you hear these stories about people who have two families. You know, they've got a secret family. And you're like, yeah, how do you do that? One family is enough. Imagine having two. And the effort of trying to keep it secret. If I had a separate secret life where I just lived by myself, I could see the attraction of that. But a second secret life with another family, be exhausting.
Well, that took an interesting turn I wasn't expecting there, Simon. But yes, quite right, quite right. Right, Crane is back on the case. I didn't, but someone did. Booked a petrol hire car, but Hertz sent me on a nightmare 560-mile trip in an EV. Helen, this is an interesting story. Tell us what happened.
It's a really interesting story, and I think it highlights a really important issue with car hire. So this is a couple who live in Australia. Back in the early part of this year, they came over to the UK to visit from some family around the country. And for one of these days, they decided to hire a car so they could drive to the Lake District to see the wife's parents. So it was a bit of an emotional day. One of them is quite unwell and may sadly have been the last time she was able to see them. So important day, they hire this car. They'd actually booked it in advance with the rental company Hertz, and when they booked it, they'd ask for a Mercedes GLA, so that would be either a petrol diesel car or a hybrid. When they turned up at the rental place, they were given a Polestar electric vehicle. So very shocked to receive this, because none of them, it wasn't what they'd booked, and neither of them had actually driven an EV before, had no idea how to charge, no idea about range, how it really worked. So obviously their first reaction was, no, can we have a petrol car? They were told that there weren't any petrol cars available, so they were lumped with the EV. The person in the Hertz rental garage told them, no, it's fine. It's dead easy to charge an EV. It only takes 15 minutes. There's chargers everywhere. So they set off with it on this 560-mile round trip. And I think you can see where this is going. They had to stop and charge, I think, 5 times on the trip. Absolute nightmare, constantly having to veer off course to try and find a charging port. They couldn't get some of them to work because, frankly, they didn't really know what they were doing. They were complete novices. At one point, they drove from the Lake District to Birmingham, which should take about 3.5 hours. It took 7 because they kept having to go off and find chargers. By the end of the day, completely stressed out. One of them was in tears. It was freezing. It was January, and they hadn't had the heating on in the car all day because they wanted to conserve the battery. It just sounded like an absolute nightmare journey. And I think it raises a good point. You know, should you be given an electric car by a rental company if you've requested a petrol car? And there's no sort of detail here. So I spoke to Hertz about it. In their initial emails, they said, oh, well, you know, we do say in our T&Cs that if we don't have the car that you've requested, you've been given a similar car. And that's the crux of it, really. Is an EV a similar car to a petrol car if it's the sort of the same size and the same spec? I mean, for some people, yes, if they know how to drive an EV and they're not going very far. But for people who are going on a 560-mile journey, it's absolutely not a similar replacement. It's completely inappropriate, I would argue. You know, EVs are great for some kind of journeys, but for that huge long trip in January where it's freezing and you haven't got the range to go the distance, you know, it's not, similar, and it's not kind of appropriate at all. So I spoke to Hertz, and in the end they did agree to refund the hire fee and also the money that they'd spent on charging, which was £112 for the sort of
round.
That's
a lot.
Which is a lot, especially compared to the cost of petrol. And I think that's another thing, you know, they didn't realise that certain charges can be cheaper or more expensive depending on things like how fast they are and who runs them. But, you know, obviously these people had absolutely no idea because they'd never driven an EV before. So I think it requires a lot of background knowledge that people didn't have. And it seems sensible that when you book a hire car, there should be an option. Are you willing to accept an electric car or not? Because I don't, you know, people might look at this and say, oh, well, you know, this is just the anti-EV lobby. Some people are just dead set against electric cars. But I don't think this is about that. I think it's about, you need a lot of knowledge to do this. You need to know how it works. And if you don't, it's just a massive hassle, especially if you're just hiring a car for the day. People don't want that. It's not about their, what they think or don't think about EVs. It's about practicality. And, if it's not suitable, it's not suitable.
But actually, I do think it does signify probably to a lot of people some of the biggest anxieties around EVs. Simon, I mean, I was astonished by how much they spent on charging. My little Mokka would get me up there and back for a third of that price. And then the stopping, oh, it just sounds, it is, it's a nightmare.
Yes. And just to be clear, right, as the man who runs motoring across This Is Money and the Daily Mail online, and as someone who has hired a lot of cars in his life and has driven plenty of electric cars as well and is a great supporter of them, and we also have an electric cars channel, an electric car is not directly interchangeable for a petrol hire car. I Hertz is, in my mind, absolutely in the wrong here.
Right.
Hertz, I don't understand why they didn't like back down on this anyway. Why they stuck to their guns on this and just say, we're sorry, okay? We just didn't have any alternative car to give you. Because if you look at Hertz's website to hire a car, and I just did that while you were talking, it quite clearly badges up electric vehicle for electric cars and other cars is not. Hertz does not treat these two things interchangeably. It is not common hire car practice at the moment to treat these two things interchangeably. If you use car hire comparison sites, if you use any car hire companies, they don't use these things interchangeably. Now, what might have gone on here is that this couple couldn't get an automatic car and they booked an automatic car and they didn't have a car available. But what is common practice is that you then upgrade that person. Okay, so if you can't give them the car that they have rented or equivalent, which is it always says or equivalent, right, then you give them a better car. You don't give them an inferior car, and you don't give them a diff, you know, a totally different car, right? And now arguably the electric car is different. And so unless they had absolutely no automatic cars at all in stock, they should have just given them an whatever automatic car they had instead. And if you look at what occurred on this disastrous journey for this poor couple, it does illustrate why people don't want to hire electric cars. And I've turned down the opportunity to hire an electric car before, which would have been cheaper than hiring a petrol one. Could have done it last January, start of February. Me and my wife were going away snowboarding for the weekend, flew into Zurich, we're driving into Austria, just renting a cheap and cheerful little car from the airport in Zurich. All we're going to do is we're going to drive from there 2 hours to the hotel, stay at the hotel, drive 2 hours back. Not going to use the car while we're there. Could have just plugged it in, let it charge, and then driven it back. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. Pretty sure the range should be enough. We're not actually going far enough that it'd run out the range. I don't want to stop and be charging. I don't want the hassle of it. And again, you know, similarly, when you're driving around, if say you've got the hire car for a week, you know, do you want the hassle of it? And it does illustrate the fact that home charging is very, very cheap. If you've got an electric car and you could charge at home, you can save an absolute packet. But at the moment, charging on the move, which has got much, much better and much, much faster, and this couple were very unlucky, but generally speaking, it's much better, it's much faster. You get a car charged up to 80% in potentially 20 minutes or 30 minutes. It is expensive though, and it is actually more expensive than filling a car up with petrol or diesel.
Helen, we're coming up to summer holidays. A lot of people will be hiring rentals, and it is one of those things that fills me with a bit of anxiety. I'm not going to lie, and probably a lot of other people. And I imagine you get quite a lot of complaints about this. Do you have any quick sort of tips of what we can do to protect ourselves? Take a video or anything like that.
I think first of all, be really clear about what you've booked. So these people did this actually. In fairness, they sort of kept the receipts, kept screenshots of the car that they'd asked for, and the sort of terms that they'd agreed, so they could go into the rental place and say, you know, look, this is what we booked. You need to give us something similar to this. Obviously, this didn't work out in this sort of exceptional circumstance, but I think, you know, do be clear with the company what you've booked. And as Simon said, if they don't have it, then you ask for an upgrade. You don't accept something inferior. I think more generally looking at electric cars, sorry, hire cars, not electric cars, do take videos and photos of the car when you get it and when you return it. This is something that some hire places actually encourage you to do now, just because they can be really funny about little sort of nicks and scrapes. And I do get a lot of emails about this, people saying, this scratch wasn't here when we gave you this car, which is often not true. I think also things to look out for is sort of mileage limits. So sometimes when you hire a car, they'll ask you to pay more if you've gone a certain amount of miles. So keep an eye on that. Also, make sure that you check the details around returning it. So obviously, you might need to return it with a certain amount of fuel, but also with EVs, some of them ask you to send it back with a certain amount of charge. So do make sure that you know the rules around that. Otherwise, you might be hit with an annoying fine.
Three things to add to watch out for. One, insurance. So they will give you the basic kind of collision damage waiver insurance. If you really want to protect the car against, you know, something going wrong with the tires, the windscreen and so on, then you will be sold, they will upsell you an insurance policy. That's really expensive at the desk. You can buy these policies individually. I would highly recommend doing that. And you can end up paying less for a year's policy than you would pay for a week's policy at the desk. Yeah. Take that paperwork with you. So when they try and upsell you, you say, I've already got the insurance. And then they say, nah, it won't pay out though. You know, because they can put the reason why car hire is such a not is the reason why car hire has so much friction in the process rather than having been simplified is because they make so much money selling you stuff and putting the pressure on at the desk. Some people at the desks are amazing. Some people at the desks are not amazing. So take your paperwork with you and say, nope, here it is. That says I'm covered. Other thing you need to have is watch out for, if you are doing that, watch out for what the excess is on the car, because you'll have to have a certain amount blocked out on your credit card to cover if something goes wrong. And one of the ways that some of the car hire companies are managing to, like, you know, deliver the really cheap prices on the comparisons is by whacking that up really high. I hired a car, needed €3,000 blocked out on my credit card. And, you know, that could be a real problem. If you don't have that limit, then you're going to have an issue, and you should be able to see that when you do the car hire comparison. So check for that and make sure you've got enough. And thirdly, on that note, make sure you've got a credit card with you in your name, because that is often where people get tripped up. They're like this, we need a credit card in your name. I don't have a credit card. We need a credit card. Can you use my debit card? No, you need a credit card. I don't have a credit card though. Can you use my debit card? No, you need a credit card. But I don't have a credit card. It says it here on the hire agreement, right in front of your face, and then you could get caught out. They might not give you the car, and you might still have to pay for it, and you have to redo it, or you might have somebody else. And sometimes, even though the person with you has a credit card in their name, they won't let them do it because their name's not on the booking. So watch out for that one, and make sure you've got a big enough credit limit on the card, as I said, to cover the excess.
3,000. Oof, that's
yeah,
a
it's
lot.
Massive, really big. Yeah.
Right. Give me another stat this week, because it's Simon's stat of the week, but I like 3,000.
Yep. Okay, here we go. In defense of electric cars, a new report, servicing over a 5-year period, a site called The Car Expert. The average outlay for servicing a petrol, diesel, or hybrid model over 5 years is £5,709. EV owners, on the other hand, pay just £4,022. That is a saving of more than £1,500 over 5 years, because EVs are actually cheaper to service.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you very much, Helen. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your questions. We will endeavour to answer them.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.